Welcome to Congress in Context.
Today, we are charting the legislative terrain right as the calendar flips.
Yeah, that strange period between December 30, 2025 and January 3, 2026.
Which marks the formal close of the 119th Congress first session.
It's sort of the political equivalent of that holiday hangover period, but, you know, Washington doesn't really sleep.
It never does, and our mission today is to distill the congressional record from these final hours. You have these massive, high-stakes conflicts defining the session's end.
Right, like the veto battles we're going to get into.
Exactly, and those are happening at the exact same time as the intensely local, deeply personal work that lawmakers are doing for their constituents.
It's a real study in legislative bandwidth, so we're going to give you the essential knowledge to understand both the, let's say, shouting matches and the whispered tributes.
The setup for these last few days was really defined by ceremonial, very quick meetings, and the arrival of some pretty aggressive executive action.
Which leads us right into the mechanics of it all.
It does. The clock was ticking, and the critical procedural moment that really set the stage for the new year happened on January 2nd, 2026.
Okay, what happened?
The record formally noted that the clerk of the House transmitted these sealed envelopes.
Sealed envelopes, that sounds dramatic.
It is. They contain messages from the president concerning his objections to two pieces of legislation, H.R. 131 and H.R. 504.
And this is where the jargon can really trip people up. For listeners who might not be, you know, fluent in legislative procedure, these final sessions were often what's called pro forma.
Right.
Can you quickly define that and maybe also explain the role of the chair here?
Absolutely. So pro forma sessions are these brief, largely ceremonial meetings. Sometimes they last just minutes.
It's to check a box, essentially.
Pretty much. They're designed to satisfy constitutional requirements for meeting regularly, but without conducting any real substantive business. It just keeps the legislative clock running.
And because they're so quick, the full Speaker of the House isn't always there?
That's right. The chair presiding over this session was Speaker Pro Tempore Bresnahan. Pro Tempore just means a temporary speaker.
So on January 2nd, this temporary chair has to handle these two major veto messages. What happens next is kind of fascinating, because they didn't immediately start the override debate.
No, they didn't. Speaker Pro Tempore Bresnahan immediately ruled that further consideration of both veto messages would be postponed.
Postponed until when?
Until the legislative day of January 8, 2026. And this postponement, it's not a sign of indecision or anything like that. It's high strategy.
Waiting almost a week seems like a long time. Is this them admitting they don't have the votes for an override, or is this just, you know, standard procedure to build up the political theater?
It's a little of both, really. A veto override needs a two-thirds majority in both chambers. That is a massive lift.
A very high bar.
A very high bar. So postponement gives the leadership critical time to count votes, to lobby members who are on the fence, and to prepare for this huge debate that's going to define the political conversation when the House really gets back to business.
Mm. So it turns a sudden executive action into a scheduled, highly publicized political showdown.
Precisely.
Okay, so that's the procedural meat. Now let's jump into the bills themselves. This is where we see the core distinction in the president's reasoning, because the language in these two veto messages is aggressive and really revealing.
Oh, absolutely. We have two vetoes here that perfectly illustrate this administration's core philosophy.
Which is?
Fiscal discipline first, and then demanding political alignment second.
Let's start with H.R. 131, the Finish the Arkansas Valley Conduit Act. This is about water infrastructure, right? A huge, decades-old project in southeastern Colorado.
It is. And the history of the Arkansas Valley Conduit, the AVC, is really key to understanding the president's anger here.
It was originally authorized way back in 1962.
Way back. And it was intended to be repaid by local users with interest over 50 years. But the project's cost just ballooned. And the viability of that whole repayment structure just collapsed.
And Congress has already tried to fix this before. The source material says that in 2009, legislation already cut the local repayment from 100% down to just 35% of the total cost.
Correct. But H.R. 131 was trying to move the goalposts again. This new bill wanted to extend the repayment period on that already reduced share by another 25 years.
So to 75 years total?
75 years, and it would cut the interest rate in half. The message from the president is basically, enough is enough.
And he didn't just stop at a policy analysis. He went straight for a political confrontation. He pointed out the estimated cost for the AVC had just skyrocketed.
From what to what?
From $249 million when it was first authorized to an estimated $1.3 billion today.
Wow. That jump from a quarter billion to over $1 billion in cost is, it's just staggering. I mean, what does that tell you about project oversight?
The president used that exact figure to frame the whole bill as a giveaway. He called the entire history of the project a mismanagement disgrace.
And the political core of this veto is just so clear. He stated H.R. 131 was, and I'm quoting here, forcing federal taxpayers to bear even more of the massive costs of a local water project.
And the aggression is all wrapped up in that final note, right? The one that was included in the official record?
It's a handwritten one.
Yeah. It just says, pay up veto. This frames the whole fight as this pure black and white battle over infrastructure spending and the national debt.
Okay, now let's pivot to the second veto, H.R. 504.
The Miccosukee Reserved Area Amendments Act.
Right, because this one adds a completely different and highly political dimension to the president's justification.
H.R. 504 was about protecting structures from flooding within the Osceola Camp in Everglades National Park, an area used by the Miccosukee tribe.
Yeah, on the surface, it sounds like a pretty typical environmental or infrastructure issue.
But it's not.
Not at all. The policy context is very unusual. The president's message laid out that the Osceola Camp was actually built without authorization way back in 1935.
And in a really low-lying area, too.
Right. Exactly. He noted the prior administration had looked at a plan costing up to $14 million to protect or replace this unauthorized infrastructure.
So his argument, the fiscal part of it, is that the federal government has no responsibility to fix problems in an area the tribe was never authorized to occupy in the first place.
That's the fiscal justification. But the really defining difference here is how he links it directly to national politics.
This is where the source material gets stark.
It really does. The president specifically tied this veto to his broader policy goals. He claimed the Miccosukee tribe has, quote, actively sought to obstruct reasonable immigration policies.
So he's publicly applying leverage. He's saying flat out that the administration is committed to preventing American taxpayers from funding projects for special interests.
Especially those unaligned with his policy of removing criminal illegal aliens.
Yes. It's a very public tactic. He's linking local benefits, in this case tribal infrastructure funding, to compliance or at least alignment with his national political agenda.
It completely shifts the veto from a simple spending debate into a direct, high-level political punishment for opposing his core policies.
The contrast is just stunning. You have the president waging war on alleged cost overruns in Colorado on one hand and on perceived political disloyalty in Florida on the other. That really defines the conflict at the highest level as the session closes.
But, you know, if the vetoes are Congress screaming, the extensions of remarks section is Congress listening.
I love that framing.
While these huge conflicts grab headlines, the legislative record also captures this essential, granular focus on local communities. And that's our next section, the people and the local connection.
I find it amazing how this part of the record captures the real heartbeat of a district. I mean, it's the only place where you see lawmakers prioritizing something like honoring a local welder over debating a billion-dollar water project.
Exactly. And on December 30th, we saw several really powerful examples. Let's look first at Representative Brian K. Fitzpatrick of Pennsylvania.
He submitted remarks honoring the life and legacy of a man named Harvey Francis Cochran, who had recently passed away. Reading this, it really grounds the entire legislative record. It reminds you this isn't just about bills, it's about documenting real people.
And the detail provided just makes the person so real. He was raised in Croydon, lived in Levittown, worked 50 years as a welder.
A devoted Philadelphia Eagles fan, a lifelong musician.
Loved gardening, cultivating flowers and vegetables, but most importantly, he was known affectionately as Coach Harv.
For his mentorship of countless young people through local sports, this is what local representation actually looks like.
It is. And then from honoring a local icon, we pivot to an instance of a constituent's experience directly driving a piece of federal legislation.
That's the entry from Representative Eleanor Holmes Norton of the District of Columbia.
She used the extension of remarks to signal the introduction of H.R. 6935, the Postal Facilities Security Camera Act.
And the urgency for this federal bill came directly from a single local event.
A D.C. resident was robbed in an unmonitored post office parking lot.
That is such a crystal clear case of accountability. A local incident leads directly to a push for national legislation to protect USPS employees and customers all across the country.
It's a very direct line from the neighborhood straight to D.C.
It is.
And our final highlight in this section comes from Representative Jimmy Gomez of California. He was celebrating community service.
He was recognizing the 50th anniversary of the Koreatown Youth and Community Center, the KYCC, in Los Angeles.
50 years. The scale of your work is just incredible. The statement says that KYCC serves over 12,500 people every year.
With a focus on youth development, housing, healthcare, and economic empowerment.
And he specifically highlighted their role during major community crises, from the unrest back in the 1990s to the recent pandemic.
Quoting him, he said the organization embodies the truth that when families are supported, communities thrive.
It really gets to the heart of it. Amidst all the partisan fire of the session's end, members are still documenting and championing the foundational pillars of their districts.
That structural contrast really defines the close of the session, doesn't it? Vetoes screaming about billion-dollar projects and demanding political obedience, while the fine print is quietly praising a mentor from Levittown.
And documenting the crucial work of a youth center in Koreatown. And the business doesn't stop. Our next section gives us a peek at other essential congressional business that just happens quietly in the background.
Right, because even with all this conflict, there are still areas of crucial collaboration.
And that would be the high-level appointments to the United States-China Economic and Security Review Commission.
These were made on December 30th, and this body is critical for national security and trade policy.
It's hugely important. And we see Speaker Mike Johnson appointing Mr. Taylor Budowich of Washington, D.C. At the same time, Democratic leader Hakeem Jeffries is appointing two individuals.
Mr. Jonathan Nicholas Stivers of Falls Church, Virginia, and Mr. Lillian Miller of Alexandria, Virginia.
So while the vetoes are intensely partisan, these appointments show the bipartisan and bicameral cooperation that's required to staff these key national security bodies. They have to agree on who gets to watch the watchers.
And we also see policy pressure flowing up from local governments, submitted as memorials. This is that direct link of state-level action to D.C.
Yep, and we saw two really contrasting examples. Alaska, for instance, urged Congress to pass the Ensuring Lasting Smiles Act.
Which is a very specific healthcare policy.
Very specific. It targets coverage for congenital anomalies. But then, conversely, we see the California General Assembly weighing in on national budget policy.
They submitted a memorial calling on Congress to repeal specific provisions of the federal One Big Beautiful Bill Act.
The context there is crucial. I mean, the name sounds vague, but this was a sprawling, politically charged measure. California is specifically calling for the repeal of elements that affect core entitlements.
Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid.
Exactly. And they're actively opposing any efforts to privatize those systems. It just shows that states are actively engaged and trying to influence the highest levels of these national debates.
This whole cycle, just a few days, really shows the incredible bandwidth Congress operates under. You have the president slamming two major bills with incredibly pointed language, the House postponing the showdown, key national security commissions being staffed, and local legislators memorializing constituents.
So if we step back, what does this all mean for the close of the year? The formal end of the first session of the 119th Congress arrived with the House's sine-die adjournment on Saturday, January 3rd, 2026.
Sine-die, another excellent piece of jargon. That means without a day, correct. A formal adjournment that definitively ends the session until a new one is called.
The books are officially shut. For a moment.
For a moment. And yet, as one legislative session formally ends, the next electoral cycle instantly begins. We found one final administrative detail buried right at the end of the day's record that signals this immediate ripple effect.
The vacancy notice.
Exactly. The Speaker pro tempore laid before the House a letter of resignation from Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia.
And her resignation is effective January 5, 2026 at 11:59 p.m. EST.
So this simple administrative filing slipped in just as the House adjourns sine-die immediately kicks off the clock for a special election in Georgia's 14th congressional district.
It guarantees that the political battleground shifts and the immediate electoral work starts, even while the legislative chambers are physically empty.
It's the ultimate Congress in context. The legislative work pauses, but the political maneuvering, it never stops. The closing detail of one battle immediately fuels the start of the next one.
And if you want to see the full pointed language of those veto messages, or read that emotional tribute to Coach Harv, or check the language of those state memorials for yourself, you can always look up these specific remarks.
The full congressional record for these dates is available directly at congress.gov.
Do the deep dive yourself.
We'll talk to you next time.